Hey everybody, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor of pediatric surgery here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, home of the Badgers. This is a podcast about surgery and the people who are at the cutting edge of it. We're glad you're here. In today's episode, we welcome Dr. Richard Davidson. Dr. Davidson has been at the University of Wisconsin for more than three decades, where he's the William James and Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, as well as the director of the Weizmann Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and the founder for the Center for Healthy Minds. His research interests focus around the neural bases for emotion and the exploration of methods that promote human well-being, including meditation and related contemplative practices. His studies have included a broad range of individuals, ranging from young to old, and have also included those with disorders of emotion, such as mood and anxiety disorders and autism, as well as expert meditation practitioners. His research collaborators include the Dalai Lama. Dr. Davidson was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2006 and Madison Person of the Year in 2007. We were truly honored to welcome him for Grand Rounds and to sit down with him for this episode of The Surgery Set.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Your Grand Rounds is obviously available online, and I just cannot recommend people to go and take a look at it. Truly an extraordinary hour-long talk about sort of the basic underpinnings of well-being from a neuropsychiatric standpoint, but also a really deep dive into what it means to be happy. And you describe in your talk a little bit, the reason that you study that now is because you met with the Dalai Lama.
I did, and I first met with him in 1992, and he challenged me in that meeting and encouraged me to use the same methods, the same neuroscientific tools, the same rigor that we were applying to the study of anxiety and depression and stress, and use those tools to study positive human qualities like kindness and compassion as a way to help focus on some of those more positive attributes, because it's his conviction that the cultivation of those positive attributes is something that we really need more of in this world today. And I think most people would agree with that.
Yeah, it's sort of extraordinary flipping of the script, right? And we so often focus in surgery, for instance, you know, we study disease, right? We study how everything breaks. But this notion of studying how you can make it better is, I think, fascinating and seems so positive as a...
Yeah, and you know, we're in the health professions. Physicians are ultimately concerned with health. The World Health Organization's definition of health includes more than the absence of illness. And we have an entity called the National Institutes of Health, but really it's mostly focused on disease. And this is a kind of counterpoint and a challenge and I think an invitation to consider the possibility that we can actually cultivate and study more optimal human functioning and that health is not simply the absence of illness.
Yeah, and to that end, you're actually an author on the World Happiness Report.
Yes, so the World Happiness Report has historically been written by economists. And beginning in 2015, they first asked me to bring a different neuroscientific perspective to this work. And so it's beginning, I think, to infiltrate into a number of different sectors. And I think that the hard-nosed neuroscientific research is helping people to take this more seriously, that this is not something that's just ephemeral, some sort of subjective epiphenomenon, but that it's actually something robust and has important biological implications and may be importantly associated with human health.
And in your talk, you go into this in great detail, but maybe you can just sort of summarize for us briefly that there are real measurable, hard-nosed indicators of changes in health related to mental state.
Absolutely. So beginning with epidemiological research, which finds an association in large population studies between well-being and various indicators of physical health, we've begun to more mechanistically interrogate what the basis of those associations might be, looking at relations between specific patterns of brain function in particular neural circuits and their association with biological indicators in the immune system, in the endocrine system, in the autonomic nervous system, all of which in different ways contribute to and modulate aspects of health. And one of the big ones is in inflammation. And we know that inflammatory processes are an important contributor to many different diseases. And we also know that psychosocial factors play a role in modulating inflammation. And so if psychosocial factors play a role in modulating inflammation, it has to operate through the brain. And we're beginning to study some of those pathways.
And some of those pathways are even epigenetic, you say, like unhappiness could potentially be something that is hereditary or passed down through generations.
Yes. So there's good neuroscientific research showing behavioral influences on epigenetic processes, which have been clearly documented now. And some of the latest findings indicate that some of those epigenetic effects are indeed passed down at least for a couple of generations. This mostly comes from animal data, but we're beginning to study these epigenetic processes in humans. And we now have techniques, which I didn't mention in my Grand Rounds talk, but we're working on now in collaboration with different groups, mostly here on campus, where we can take, for example, a peripheral blood mononuclear cell and convert it to a pluripotent stem cell and then turn that stem cell into a neuron, a specific neuronal subtype, and actually study gene expression patterns in the specific neuronal subtype and do that non-invasively in a human being.
Just extraordinary. It's such like this opening of the black box of the mind. I mean, some of the things you show in your talk, you know, monks who've devoted their lives, you know, tens of thousands of hours of meditation practice and who clearly now you can show have, you know, EEG findings that are remarkably different from us. But you also talk a little bit about something that I think is probably more accessible to our audience, which is, you know, small things you can do to improve the neurophysiology and neurochemistry around mindfulness and well-being. For those of us who don't have 10,000 hours to meditate, like what can we do as, you know, surgeons who have busy days and complex lives to be better?
Well, I think that there are things that we can all do, and it actually doesn't require taking any time out of the day. It can be done while you're commuting to work, while you're walking between patients, harnessing these kind of interstitial moments and intentionally directing the mind. We can do simple mindfulness practices to calm the mind. And we can also do simple kindness and compassion practices where we can envision other individuals and recognize that we all share the same wish to be happy and to be free of suffering. And we can cultivate feelings of warmth and compassion toward other people in this way, very simply. And it's really accessible. And even if we do this in little 1 minute bursts that we sprinkle throughout the day, there is evidence in the scientific literature to indicate that even those small number of minutes can make a difference, and particularly if they're done repeatedly over time.
I know for me, like, I've taken to reading Twitter in the stairwells as I'm like going up and down, and it has decreased my mindfulness and happiness a lot. So using that time to do something better,
yeah,
it might be just the thing, right? That those little intervals, those times between patients or moving around the hospital.
Absolutely. You can do a 30-second little practice. And I do this all the time, you know, during a busy day, between appointments, even when I'm with a person, just simple reminders internally that we all share this same wish to be happy and to be free of suffering, sending feelings of warmth. When I travel a lot. When I walk through airports, it's a time of people often very stressed. Just having positive thoughts about others, also expressing gratitude. You know, that's something that really doesn't take a lot and has profound effects. And so using every occasion that is appropriate to express gratitude. Simply thank you for whatever it is. Simple, small things. And when we reflect on a typical daily life, even the life of a super hardworking surgeon, the percentage of the day that's filled with small positive things, I think, outweighs the percentage that is filled with negative things. We don't pay that much attention to the positive. And of course, all the negative stuff gets amplified in the media, all the negative things that are going on in the world. But the number of positive things that occur each day, I think, far outweighs the number of negative things. And I think simple reminders can be very, very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, these are not soft, sort of hand-wavy things, right? Feeling gratitude, expressing kindness towards others changes your neuroplasticity and has measurable hard-nosed effects.
It does. And that's what really is different about making these statements today compared to 10 years ago. We now have a growing body of serious scientific evidence suggesting that we do have this kind of plasticity in the brain. The brain does change in response to these simple kinds of strategies. And, you know, in some sense, what we're talking about is mind and brain health. And we know that given the interconnections between the brain and biological systems in the body, that it could indeed be meaningful for physical health as well.
Yeah. Again, I think, you know, we have a lot of Grand Rounds. We talk about a lot of cool things. I tell everyone to go and see the Grand Rounds because they're all interesting, but this one is exceptional. And mostly because I think it sort of reminds us as scientists, you know, who are sort of hard-nosed people, that there are measurable scientific effects that you can do randomized controlled trials and actually demonstrate the benefit of something that we all just sort of acknowledge feels good and is important in our own lives. But this way you can see it with a p-value, which maybe makes it a little bit more impactful for those of us who sort of live in that world. What today could I do to sort of start that practice? And where do I go? What resources are the right place to start?
Well, on our website, as I mentioned in the Grand Rounds, we have a plethora of information available. We have practices that we've studied scientifically that are freely available for download. And there's a lot of material available on the internet. And my view is, and the scientific data bears this out, that one size is not going to fit all. Anyone who says that you should do this particular technique, you know, it may be helpful for specific types of people, but it's not going to be helpful for everyone. So I would encourage people to just try something and do it regularly that seems to mesh with their lifestyle and try it for a few weeks and see how it's working. There are a lot of resources available, and I would encourage people to start very, very modestly. What we often do is ask a person, what's the minimum amount that you feel you can make an absolute commitment to do every single day for the next 30 days? Even if it's 2 minutes a day, that's fine. But do 2 minutes every day for 30 days and then see how it is. I don't think there's anyone who can honestly say they can't take 2 minutes. I mean, we take more than 2 minutes to brush our teeth every day. This is kind of the same thing. We think of this as personal mental hygiene.
Absolutely. Your website is
centerhealthyminds.org.
Centerhealthyminds.org. We'll link to it off our website as well. Again, I just want to thank you so much for a really marvelous, illuminating talk that I think is going to change a lot of lives. So
thank you so much. Appreciate it.
If you enjoy The Surgery Set or have suggestions on how we can make our program better, please provide us with your feedback. You can rate our podcast and leave your comments on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher. More comments makes it easier for people to find us, so please leave your rating and your comments. Or you can always just send us email at podcast@surgery.wisc.edu. Join us next time when we hear from Dr. Dana Henkel. She's a former physician's assistant and current general surgery chief resident here at UW. She discusses the impacts her work as a PA had on her career and talks about the roles of advanced practice providers in medicine.
You know, a lot of people talk about NPs and PAs as the same thing, but PAs are different because PAs are trained in the medical model of teaching, just like medical school, and nurses are trained in the nursing model.
The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Veronica Watson and myself. It was recorded by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health video library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher, and of course you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery or at J.E. Kohler, that's K-O-H-L-E-R. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing and don't hesitate to let us know of any topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, we hope you check back soon.